Chapter 21. Chotek did not entirely agree with my opinion that Perkins rescuing the two pilots posed zero risk of exposing our involvement. It took a lot of convincing, and in the end, Lieutenant Colonel Chang had the deciding vote. The fact is, Chotek trusted the calm, steady experience of Chang to me. When Chang told our UN mission commander that the operation posed no additional risk, Chotek very reluctantly agreed. I think Chotek appreciated me requesting permission from him, rather than making a snap decision on my own. That helped our relationship later when I really needed him to cut me some slack and trust me. Okay, we have the green light from the mission commander. We need to send a message to Perkins, telling her to pick up Lieutenant Bonsu. Sir, Adams interjected. We can't send a message about picking up a human. Envy is supposed to be a native Ruhar group. They would care about the injured Ruhar pilot, not about a human. Oh, I mentally chided myself for being a dumbass. That is an excellent point, Sergeant. Do that, Skippy. Done. Message sent, Colonel, Skippy announced cheerily. While we're waiting for a reply from Major Perkins, I have a question for you, Joe. If it's about calculus or poetry, it is unlikely I have an answer. I will take a risk on that, Skippy chuckled. You said that you don't want to be a pogue. I'm not sure that I understand that reference. A pogue is a soldier who serves in a support unit, not in combat. And supposedly it stands for persons other than grunts, but I think that was made up later.
Ah, I thought that was a fobbit, Joe.
Fobbit is a newer term, from when the army started setting up forward operating bases. Before that was Remph, for rear echelon motherfucker. Those are the assholes who sleep in a real bed every night, while infantry grunts are lucky to find rock to sleep on. Okay, Remph and pogue. I will add those to my list of colorful expressions. Joe, I have noticed that your language has become less, I guess the best word would be, salty since we met. Yes, Skippy. I tapped the silver eagles on my uniform. The army expects me to be an officer and a gentleman now. I can't be dropping F-bombs all over the place. Although I knew some colonels who used very salty language.
You. A gentleman.
So that means you clean up your language?
What's next? Will you be serving afternoon tea? Those little sandwiches with the crusts cut off? Ooh, and ballroom dancing lessons for you.
Skippy?
Yes?
I dropped a whole string of F-bombs until Adams burst out laughing. Skippy chuckled also. There's the Joe I know. Derek stumbled on a rock and fell to one knee. He leaned forward as he fell so he wouldn't fall backward and injure Saley. The pilot behind him groaned.
Saley, he asked, are you awake?
She didn't respond. He looked at the terrain in front of them. It was a meadow with clusters of trees dotted here and there. In a meadow, he didn't have to constantly duck to avoid Saley's head being hit by low-hanging tree branches. But while a forest had some undergrowth, a meadow was all undergrowth. Tall grasses, vines, and shrubs could tangle his feet and hide holes he couldn't see. The worst part of crossing the meadow was that it sloped up, and there was no way around climbing something. He needed to go northwest, and the map showed the meadow had the gentlest slope in the area. That was why he was stumbling across it. Saley groaned again. Exhausted and lightheaded from deep hunger, Derek let his other knee down and unbuckled the strap that held the pilot to his back. Saley had fallen the day before and been unable to rise. Then she'd become unconscious. The nanoparticles in her blood were conserving her remaining blood supply by making her sleep. While she was asleep, she wasn't moving and causing additional stress on the injuries the nanoparticles had hastily stitched together. When she had been awake, Saley had warned him that she might fall into sort of a coma if the nanobots in her blood decided that was the only way to extend her life. Ruhar biology had a way to go into a type of hibernation during times of extreme stress and deprivation. In the deep, coma-like hibernation, Ruhar bodies used very little oxygen, water, and stored fuel. They could also withstand cold temperatures for lengthy periods. It wasn't a pleasant experience, she explained, but she'd undergone a practice hibernation during boot camp military training. The hibernation ability wasn't an original feature of Ruhar biology. That had been added long ago using genetic engineering. That same tweaking of Ruhar DNA was the reason she was still alive. She had superior healing abilities. Enhanced genetics and nanobots were, Derek thought, very good things to have. Right then, his growling stomach would have settled for a sandwich. The previous night, Derek had injected her with the last vial of energy juice, so she was now running out of sugar or whatever Ruhar biochemistry used for fuel. He unbuckled the lower strap and let the Ruhar pilot slump gently backwards until she lay on the grass. Touching her neck, he was surprised to find her pulse strong and fast, until he realized that what he was feeling was his own pulse pounding in his fingertip from exertion. "I need to rest," he said to no one but himself. 2 hours later, by the clock on his Z-phone, he woke up when the clouds parted and a shaft of sunlight illuminated the meadow. Panicked, he rolled to his knees and checked on Saley. She was as he had left her, breathing very slowly, her pulse slow and weak, non-responsive. Shaking his canteen told him it was almost full, so he parted her lips with his fingers and very slowly dribbled half of the water into her mouth, letting her automatically swallow. Then he greedily drank the other half of the water. The map said there was a stream cutting across the meadow near the top, where the meadow ended and the woods resumed. He could refill the canteen there. One advantage of being in an alien biosphere was that none of the microorganisms in the water could harm him or Saley. With a start, he woke again 20 minutes later. Hunger pangs were what caused him to waken. They weren't going to get any better. "Time to make a decision, Bonsu," he said to himself. He couldn't go much further carrying Saley. He could barely stand on his own. 10 meters away was a grove of trees centered on one large tree. That was a good place. He staggered to his knees, then one on one foot, then the other. Holding the Ruhar under her arms, he slowly dragged her backwards until she rested against the large trees, looking toward the east. Then, carefully, so he didn't fall as spots formed in his vision, he sat down beside her. "Nice spot, isn't it?" he asked Saley. "Great view." Looking eastward, he imagined he could see where they had come from. There was the hill they had skirted to the north. And was that the lake they had walked around? It was in the marshy area, just beyond the lake, that Saley had fallen. That time she had been able to walk again after a short rest, but half an hour later she had slumped unconscious, and Derek had rigged up straps to carry her on his back. They weren't going to make it to safety. He'd known that since the message came back that the Ruhar had no assets to spare for an air rescue, and they were too far in the wilderness for anyone to hike in to get them in time. From twisting contrails he'd seen high in the sky since they were shot down, the air battle was still ongoing, although mostly he'd seen only one or two contrails at a time. Both sides must be running low on combat aircraft. Since the Ruhar replied that no rescue would be coming anytime soon, Derek's plan had changed from walking to a settlement, where Saley could get medical care, to walking toward a settlement. At that point, it was about not giving up, about making progress. It was about showing the Ruhar that humans were reliable partners, and mostly, it was about doing something other than laying down and starving to death. Or, it had been about that, back when he had not been so weak that he no longer had a choice. He was awakened by an annoying buzzing sound. Automatically, he slapped at the air until he remembered there were no flying insects on Paradise. Native life on the planet had not evolved that far yet. What was that sound? Now that he noticed, it was bothering him because it was right at the edge of his hearing. What the hell was it? Paradise had insects that chirped or buzzed. He was familiar with most of those. No, it couldn't be insects buzzing in the meadow, because the sound came from one direction rather than all around him. What was even more odd was the sound was moving north to south and growing louder. With a sudden shock, he recognized the sound. It was aircraft jet engines in stealth mode. The Kristang. The Ruhar had no aircraft to spare for a rescue, but the Kristang must have sent one of their aircraft. Were they picking up the signal from Saley's emergency locator beacon? She said she had deactivated it. Maybe the Kristang picked up the beacon back then and were now searching for downed Ruhar aircrew. Derek tried to stand up, but he couldn't. He got to his knees, regretting they had discarded Saley's sidearm along the way. The weapon would not have activated for Derek anyway. It still would have felt better to have it in his hand and pointed toward the Kristang, or to shoot Saley than himself. He knew he did not want to be captured, and he was sure Saley felt the same way. Now, damn it, he didn't have a choice. The sound grew much louder now, and a faint shadow fell across him. The aircraft was between him and the sun, and it must have its stealth field engaged. It sounded very much like a buzzard. He had never heard the Kristang ship that was their equivalent of a buzzard. Probably it was similar. The faint shadow moved out over the meadow. Then he could see the vague blob that was an aircraft in stealth. The air around the stealth field shimmered. In an atmosphere, stealth fields were only useful as long ranges. "Oh my God," he gasped when the aircraft dropped its stealth field as it approached the meadow for landing. It was a buzzard. He recognized not only the shape but the insignia. It was from the 18th Air Squadron. He knew some of those Ruhar. The 18th had flown into his airbase for joint exercises. Derek found the strength to hold on to the tree and rise unsteadily to his feet. He waved to the buzzard with one arm, holding the tree with the other. The Ruhar were not there for him. They had come for Saley. If they took her, that did not guarantee they would take a human with them. Derek knew many Ruhar still hated humans, especially Ruhar who were native to Gitanu. If the crew of that buzzard were going to leave him behind to starve, they were going to have to look him in the eye before they took off. Mentally prepared for Ruhar soldiers to shove him aside and take only Saley, he was shocked when the buzzard's side door opened and two humans stepped out. "Lieutenant Bonsu," the woman said. "I'm Major Perkins. This is Specialist Coulter." Derek kept enough of his wits to point toward his feet. "I have an uninjured Ruhar pilot with me. Please help her." "We will," Perkins said. "And you need food. We have it."
"Success, Joe," Skippy said excitedly. "Major Perkins picked up Lieutenant Derek Bonsu and the Ruhar pilot. Bonsu will be fine after he gets some food. He also has a shoulder injury that should be looked at if he is going to regain full function. The Ruhar pilot is in self-induced hibernation. Specialist Jarrett has administered a stabilizing drug that was in the buzzard's medical kit. The pilot needs medical care. Expert Ruhar medical care. Soon." "Maybe when this is over," I mused, "this Derek guy will get taken care of by the Ruhar."
"Derek," Adams said thoughtfully. "I dated a Derek in high school."
I thought she was going to say more about her dating experience, but Skippy interrupted.
"That's a coincidence, Sarge Marge. Joe dated a Margaret in high school."
"Everyone called her Meg," I started to explain.
"It didn't end well," Skippy said, sounding amused already. "Her father got upset because Joe peed her name in the snow outside her house, if you know what I mean."
"Skippy, it didn't exactly happen like—"
"What really got her father upset was that he recognized it was written in his daughter's handwriting."
"Oh, boy," I groaned. "You know, people used to get a pass on doing things when you're young and stupid, and after a while everyone forgot about it."
"That was before everything lived forever on Facebook, Joe."
I sighed, knowing he was right.
"Any chance you can erase all that embarrassing stuff when we get back to Earth, Skippy?"
"Oh," Skippy snorted.
"Easy peasy, Joe."
"Great," I brightened with hope.
"Thank you."
"But what's the fun in that?" Skippy asked.
"It would be way more fun if someone took all the embarrassing stuff that people have forgotten about and added it to your profile, which might have happened shortly before we left Earth."
"Might have?"
"Well, I'm speculating here, Joe. Someone might have done that, plus added really embarrassing stuff about you from your sister's diary, like your bedwetting, and the time she caught you playing with yourself. Times, I should say. Was it 2 or 3 times? I mean, who gets excited looking at the women on the cover of your mother's romance novels?"
Desai exploded with laughter, and Adams couldn't help joining her.
"I'm sorry, sir,"
Desai managed to say while avoiding looking at me. "Adams," I groaned with my forehead gently banging against the table. "Do you have a sidearm?"
"Yes, Colonel," she managed to say while laughing. "You want me to shoot Skippy?"
"I don't think anything short of a planet-cracking nuke would hurt him," I muttered. "Could you put your sidearm against my head and pull the trigger a couple times? Put me out of my misery?"
"I think that would be against some sort of regulation, sir," she apologized.
"It's a mercy killing," I pleaded. "There's no way I can go back to Earth now."
"Why, Joe?" Skippy asked.
"Is it because of the outstanding warrants?" "Don't worry. The statute of limitations on indecent exposure is only like 5 years, I think."
"Not helping, Skippy. You are not helping one bit."
"Joe, making you face your shortcomings is helping you in the long run," Skippy protested.
"Also, a lot of fun for me, although of course that was not my motivation. That you know of."
The next time a beer can on a dusty shelf starts talking to me, I'm going to walk out and lock the door behind me.
Whoa, slow down there, partner, Jesse cautioned as Derek greedily gulped a container of nutrient mush and reached for another. Your stomach is shrunk. You need to go slow.
Is that, Derek mumbled through a mouthful of mush, chocolate chip cookies?
He pointed to a box in Jesse's lap.
Yes.
Jesse lifted the box out of the pilot's reach.
Damn, he thought. This is like dealing with a child. Well, the man had to be damned hungry by now.
They are real honest-to-God chocolate chip cookies from...
He was about to say America, but the box said Belgium.
Earth. You eat two of those mushes and let your stomach get used to it. Then you can have a cookie. Right, ma'am?
Perkins looked up from her tablet and nodded.
That's right, Lieutenant Bonsu. You do what the man says.
Yes, Major, Bonsu said shakily.
Is this a Special Forces unit, ma'am?
He asked that skeptically. None of the five had Special Forces unit insignia on their uniforms.
Hell yes, Jesse answered seriously. We're the most Special Force you've ever seen.
Not exactly, Perkins said.
Excuse me, ma'am, Shauna interjected. I think Jesse is right. Has there ever been a mission more special than this? We destroyed a battle group.
Perkins paused.
You may be right about that. Lieutenant Bonsu, we're going to drop your pilot off someplace that has a Ruhar medical facility.
To the relief of Perkins, there had not been any discussion of ignoring the Ruhar pilot after they picked up Bonsu.
Then our secret will be out anyway, so you might as well hear it now.
We... Irene called from the cockpit.
Major Perkins, could you come up here, please?
Perkins stood, holding onto a strap, as Irene was flying the Buzzard close to the ground and the flight was not smooth.
Jarrett, Coulter, tell Lieutenant Bonsu what we've been doing.
We will,
Shauna acknowledged.
Lieutenant, let's start with three words, okay? Giant, Mazer, Cannons.
They selected a medium-sized village that had a fully equipped hospital, no Ruhar military presence, and was comfortably within the Buzzard's range of its depleted power cells. Irene warned that they needed to go back to the truck and refuel after dropping the Ruhar pilot off. The Buzzard would be flying on reserves just to get back to the truck. Perkins considered waiting until darkness, but Bonsu insisted that Saley was in a coma already, and she could not wait any longer unless they wanted responsibility for a dead Ruhar pilot. So Perkins ordered Irene to land the Buzzard on the hospital's landing pad. Irene began extending the rear ramp as the landing gear came down. As soon as the Buzzard settled its weight on the landing pad, Dave and Jesse carried Saley out. Shauna escorted them, a Ruhar rifle in her arms, the muzzle pointed at the ground but a finger alongside the trigger in case of trouble. A door opened, and three confused Ruhar stepped out of the hospital. There had not been a call from an incoming aircraft, and now there were three humans in front of them. One of the humans had a rifle. A Ruhar rifle. Humans were not supposed to have weapons at all. Jesse and Dave laid Saley down carefully, then backed away with their hands up. The three Ruhar were not looking at Jesse and Dave. They were looking at the rifle in Shauna's hands. Dave pointed at Saley.
Help her,
he shouted in Ruhar over the whine of the Buzzard's engines.
Help her.
One of the Ruhar nodded, so the three humans backed away, Shauna last. At the very top of the ramp, she hit the button to retract the ramp and shouted for Irene to go. Irene lifted off very gently, wary of her jet exhaust kicking up debris and injuring the Ruhar. When she reached 100 meters altitude, she engaged the stealth field and pointed the Buzzard's nose straight toward the truck.
We don't have the fuel to fly a maximum stealth course, she explained to Derek in the co-pilot seat.
While the man was still too weak to take the controls, he could monitor instruments for her. Derek had trained on Buzzards before switching to chicken gunships.
You're sure the truck is still there? Derek asked. It had better be, or we'll be walking.
The Buzzard made it back to the truck and they refueled, although they were only able to supply half of the fuel the Buzzard could hold.
We're not going to be flying far, ma'am, Irene told Perkins. I hope Embi doesn't expect us to bring more than one projector online. We're done doing this all by ourselves. The Kristang have dozens of teams searching for projectors, Perkins frowned.
They knew about the Kristang from listening to chatter on the Ruhar civilian network. Although the Kristang still didn't know exactly where additional projectors might be located, they could guess, based on where they would have installed projectors.
It's time for the Ruhar to take over this task. I'm messaging MB now.
Prepared for an argument, Perkins was pleasantly surprised when MB immediately agreed that it was time for the Ruhar planetary government to be officially brought into the effort to activate and control projectors. MB was going to send a message to Ruhar government officials, but Perkins had a better idea.
I'm going to call someone I know, she typed. After I talk with her, you can send her a message.
MB agreed.
Paterna Logelia's phone beeped with a priority call, and she answered it automatically, assuming it was one of her staff calling.
Hello, Burgermeister.
It was a human voice, speaking acceptable Ruhar with a heavy accent.
This is Major Emily Perkins.
Paterna held the phone away from her ear and stared at it. How had Perkins made her phone beep with a priority message?
Hello, Major Perkins. How are you?
Where are you? Paterna wanted to ask. Perkins and three other humans escaped from a train and the Ruhar had not been able to find any trace of them.
I am well,
Perkins spoke precisely, as many human expressions did not translate into the alien language.
We have been busy. We escaped from a train, then we stole a truck, and we stole an aircraft. Also, we rescued two pilots who had been shot down. Oh, and before that, we were flying around activating giant maser cannons.
Paterna gasped, loudly enough that Perkins could hear.
Would you be interested, Perkins asked, in learning where all the other projectors are located? It has gotten to the point where my team needs help. We can show you how to access and activate a projector, and our friend can give you a map of all the projectors on the planet.
Your friend?
Paterna asked cautiously, while frantically waving to get the attention of her staff.
We call our friend MB. Check your phone for a message. It should be there now.